Hey guys, this is And the Writer Is, and I'm your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of writers and artists over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life and the industry, politics, composition, whatever. If you ask me, songwriters are some of the most worldly and intelligent people I've ever come across. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. Now I'm co-producing this with my friend Joe London, who was nominated for a Grammy earlier this year for Best Country Song. He makes us sound like angels. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, go to Spotify and look up our playlist, And the Writer Is, or go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Also, I was a guest this week on our friend's podcast, Switched On Pop. They dissect songs from a compositional musicology standpoint. This week we did Shape of You for Ed Sheeran, so that was a fun time. Check that out on iTunes. And now to And the Writer Is.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, this week's guest is Mike Caron. Mike Caron is one of the most influential people in the music business. There are execs across the industry who were once Mike's assistants. And there are writers who are at the very top whose first session came because of Mike Caron. There are artists who are playing Super Bowls and arenas who broke because of Mike Caron. And I guarantee I'm not the only writer in the music business that has a little Mike Caron sitting on his shoulders in writing sessions. And that's because he's the Billy Bean from Moneyball for songwriting. That's what he does. He analyzes songwriting and production in such detail that he consistently changes the game. As long as I've been in the music business, Mike Caron has had songs somewhere on the radio. But he didn't start in a vacuum. Mike is a hit writer and a hit producer. So you don't become the head of Warner A&R Worldwide if you don't know a thing or two about songwriting. So without further ado, here is this week's episode of And the Writer Is. Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Our guest today is one of the most powerful people in the music business. He's been listed in Billboard 40 Under 40. He's president of Worldwide A&R for Warner Music Group labels and runs one of the strongest independent publishing management companies in the world. Meanwhile, he's produced hit records and opened the door for dozens of aspiring writers, including myself. From Los Angeles, California, this man is a master of the music industry. And the writer is the industry's entrepreneur, Mike Caron.
Thank you. That was a nice setup.
Know. I figure I should start with something nice. I won't rip you to shit, I promise. I like you. First of all, we've done a bunch of these, and I kind of think you're like the Kevin Bacon of the music industry.
Okay.
Like, everybody has a major connection to you. I don't know if you realize, how much you've impacted the beginning of writers' careers? And
I don't know. I enjoy being around writers and artists at the beginning of their career. I mean, it's the energy and excitement and passion. Everything is new, and the first placement, the first hit, the first award, it's just like you feel the energy. You see it in people's eyes. And being around the superstars on the sixth album that are upset because they're, casting blame for, something for not being at the pinnacle at that particular moment when they so unaware of, even how lucky they are to remain in the business is deflating,
Sure.
So, but it all really comes from, you know, having no relationships when I went into business, knowing right. no one, no family, friends, no inside track with anyone of any stature, and figuring that, you know, the only access I would have is to the, you know, to the artists and the writers and the producers that no one else is talking to.
Yeah.
And now I feel that was like a blessing because it.
Yeah. I mean, I always say, I think your forte from my perspective has always been that you have never put a name before a hook. Like you don't care who gives you the hook. You'll just take it if yeah. it's a hit. But that's a really confident way to look at the music industry. Cause I mean, we come across all kinds of people who have bravado, think they know what a hit is, but you're picking out bands from the middle of nowhere. I mean, in my case, I got a phone call from Alex, your old assistant, who's now one of your hit producers, you know, who then calls my manager of my band at the time and says, there's some song called Encore that you liked that somebody sent you for something, whatever it was. You guys found a way to track me down to say, hey, why don't you come in to sessions? And you didn't even do really a meeting. You were like, hey, come in and let's write with, I think the first one was like Asher or Roth, and maybe it was, you know, or it was like Akon or it was Flo Rida or CeeLo. You never cared that I had zero credits. I mean, does that affect your, it has to affect some confidence sometimes when you're thinking, man, I don't know, I like this song, but this person has no track record, doesn't it, or no?
I mean, well, you said a few things. First, there's a quote that has been attributed to a lot of different people that I say all the time. Someone even made me a coffee mug on my desk with the quote on it, which is, you know, talking about music is like dancing to architecture.
Right.
So I try to do as few meetings as possible. Some try to avoid people taking it personally, but I really love listening to music. That's the part, the best parts of this business is listening to great music, is being around creative people with great energy, watching things, you know, coalesce and manifest and become something from nothing. I'm confident in my taste or my ability to recognize melodies or lyrics, cleverness, understanding, you know, like connection with sort of human nature and psychology and all these things. I try to describe it and figure out what it is. You know, I've been like reading about Maslow and his like hierarchy of needs and how that relates to song concepts and
how that relates to song concepts.
Well, I mean, everything's loose because there's no rules in the music business. That's great. You know, one of the best things about the business is that, you know, you can find an artist that, you know, the next great artist any day. Every day you wake up, I'd like check my email. There's all these songs and ideas that are in there that came overnight from Europe or from this late night studio sessions, and any day can be like Christmas Day, and you hear something, you get something incredible that's gonna make you a fortune or change your life. And in the same thing, every time you walk into a studio session, some magic could happen. As far as the hierarchy of needs, you know, if you're thinking theoretically, how what a hit is something that usually emotionally connects with the most amount of people, right? So I always use the example of like the I smoke cigarettes as something marginal. You know, I don't think there's going to be a significant amount of people singing along to a song called I Smoke Cigarettes that don't smoke. There may be a few like, you know, wannabes that think that's cool. But even people who smoke cigarettes may not want to, you know, particularly broadcast that message out there. So then if you have a, you know, a song, I Am a Woman, right? Probably at best you're, you know, 52% of the population can sing along. Right. So you're starting to think about what does everyone agree with? And then there's hierarchy of needs is first you need air, you know, water, and, you know, and then once you food. Once you've, you know, gotten that desire, that need down, you then seek protection, shelter. And then the next level of the need is, I think, something is like, you know, relationships, and you get up to like, you know, to self improvement and all these things. So at the core of it, we all have the same needs. And we all, once we've achieved those needs, we move, you know, we get to the next tier of the...
So you're thinking that songs conceptually can be about these needs to touch more people, that that's the correlation?
I think songs in general that really affect people express an emotion that help them express an emotion that they have to say. Either that they know how to say I love you, but they want a new way to say it, because just saying I love you over and over and over has maybe a diminishing impact. So saying it in a different way or to a melody or something is valuable. So so you're helping people express. And so if you express something that only a limited amount of the population agree with, it has less chance to be as broad a hit. So if you're, you mentioned Asher Roth, I love college.
Right.
So that's a statement that people either agree or disagree with.
Right.
The song has a ceiling to connect with, you know, people who agree with that statement or think or want to express that statement.
Did you know that when you were involved in that song? I mean, how did you know that at that time? What point did you realize, oh yeah, this song has a ceiling? When you were writing, we're like, oh, this is a smash. We love this song. Or was it sort of a thing?
I knew it at a ceiling, but I also think in like American culture, people love, they cherish their high school and college memories. A lot of cultures, that's lame. But but we have, you know, pop successful movies that,
you've now shrunken into a domestic few people who've gone through college and enjoy it.
Where it's like a cherished, special memory in your life. A lot of people, you know, they're... greater memories are, not connected to school. It is an American culture thing. Sure. We do celebrate university in a different way than international. But so I thought it could connect with the people who aspire to look forward to going to college and having that fun in college or remember, have the fond memories of college. But that's a significant amount of population. That's not everybody. Some didn't go to college and never wanted to or don't think it's cool. But going to that, to every song, it's how many people will agree to this, and then how many people want to express this emotion, and is this presented in a way that they will express either because they feel that way, or they want to be ironic, or they want to be funny, or they want to flirt. Like in the room with writers, I'm always asking when the lyric is, I see you in the stars, I ask, turn to someone in the room, look in their eyes, and try to get these words out of your mouth.
You can.
And if you can, if it's not
conversational. But it's weird because, when you're saying that in a way that there are no rules and to music and to writing, but yet I think of... when I think of the APG experience for somebody who's learning how to be a writer, and I know how many people you've had come through this building, first I was thinking it's like the Brill Building, but it is more like a school. I feel like it's a school because on some level you literally have sort of, these are parameters that you should at least be aware of. Even though there are no rules, here are some rules, or here are some things to avoid.
Well, I've heard both the Brill Building and the school, and I've realized we're more like a, coaches on a team. You're not, you have a time with a great coach. He gives you some strategy. He gives you some drills. He gives you some things to take into consideration. Sure. But when you're on, you're really on the court, you're going to use a little bit of what you've learned. You're going to take those things into consideration, but you're going to be your own player.
Well, instinct as a writer is so much a part of it, and that's not something you can teach very well.
Yeah.
Instinct is something you can refine, but on some level, it's still your instinct.
Absolutely, and I look at it more like we have no rules. We offer sort of a buffet of tools, of resources.
Sure.
Really,
every writer, all those guys have a little Mike Caron on their shoulder somewhere. Like I know every one of those guys at some point has been in a session where they've been like, where they've probably even vocalized, I remember that conversation with Mike, and he said, "Well, what if you ask a question, then the person listening is gonna wanna answer it. If you're gonna all these tricks that I still think of, even though I've been in it for a while now, some of these things are real like Mike Caronisms."
I always say, we are in this computer era. You can save things. You can try things two or three different ways. You can balance them down and then listen to them next morning and see what feels good. Or
you don't have
playing
to bring
around.
The whole band out to re-record the song anymore.
Well, you're right. not, you know, you're not like, this isn't a precious canvas or a stone where you're going to chisel it and it's there permanently. You can have versions. You can even let the public enjoy multiple versions of something and see what resonates with them. But yeah, I do have those theories that I share, and I say, you know, there is like, I finally found the word for it, and now I'm of course gonna forget it, but I think it was called interjection, where a chorus, if you want people to pay attention to a chorus, yeah, and it to be a summary and it to be a statement and it for it to suck people in, then you want to get their attention.
Sure.
So, you know, there is a human nature. How do you stop someone and how do you get them to pay attention? Right. If you drop something and you want them to notice, you say, oops, and everyone turns around to see what happened.
Right.
You know, if you're on the street and you're trying to get a girl's number, trying to stop them, and especially if you're a construction worker, you know, you're like, you're gonna use one of several, you know, sort of familiar ways to catch someone's attention, you know. So,
when you were saying, the first thing you said was that your parents weren't in the industry, you had no one who really helped you out in any of this. It was that you had to sort of grind your way into it. Who taught you this stuff? I mean, who are the people who really pulled you from being a kid who, I know you were doing like DJ stuff and obviously some production stuff. So how did you go from being, I'm a producer at home, because at one point you were, and you were that obscure guy, this can't totally be exactly how you imagined your career to turn out.
No.
Or is it?
No. I mean, it's just 1,000 trial and errors. You know, when I was in high school, I didn't really understand. I didn't know about record companies. I was, DJing, and I, started a little radio show in order to be able to have an excuse. I found out that labels give free music to DJs on the radio. So I figured out a way to become a DJ to call labels to get the free music. And then I saw like a 4-track and how that could, you know, be an advantage for sort of making mixtapes. And then bought an 8-track and started recording my neighbors and friends of friends. And, you know, by the time, you know, halfway through high school, I had, you know, was recording Black Eyed Peas songs. But I mean, who knew? They were just some kids from Pally, and then just trial and error.
You still keep in touch with them? I mean, obviously there's some career wise, but do you guys keep in touch as friends? Sort of like, this is crazy what's going on with our lives?
I don't know if we have like really had that conversation with Will, but we're in regular contact, and we laugh about things from people. We're still friends with a lot of people from 20 years ago, from back then. And, you know, it's such a small world. He had the faux Rari, which was a yellow, I forgot what it was. It was like it's just this yellow, like 20-year-old sports car that like was all beat up that he had like a little kit on. And it was a fake, in his mind, it was Ferrari.
The faux Rari.
Yeah.
In my Rari. It's like, I'm going to, they should do a remix of that.
Exactly. Yeah. So high school. So I started doing marketing. I didn't know there was an A&R department that signed and developed acts. I brought them some acts because I felt like some of the acts that we were marketing weren't as good as other artists that were out there that were available. I didn't know that was something you would make a full-time job. And then when we were making records, I just didn't understand things. I didn't understand why you had to spend $1,500. I understand I had a little studio from my high school in my house, in my dorm room or apartment, and I didn't understand why we always went to some big fancy recording studio where I felt like so intimidated, and you know, the clock was ticking and it was burning $200 an hour, and you know, because there's a lot of sessions that you spend 12-14 hours on, and at the end of the session you're in your car riding home knowing that it was a complete waste of time and that you have nothing to show for it. And you know, instead of feeling miserable, I feel like, you know, no big deal, in a lower pressure situation. So everything was sort of an evolution of, why isn't the business work this way? And like, you know, the publishing company was a manifestation of publishers used to call me and say, hey, what record are you working on? Like, you know, who are you using? Who are the writers? Who are the producers? And I'd be like, oh, I found this kid at the Verizon store, and he's really talented. He's doing half this album. And they say, can you introduce me to him? I'd introduce him, and then that person would call me, like, a few months later, say, hey, thank you for the introducing. That guy wrote me a huge check, right? And then, like, 6 months after that or a year after that, he called me. The same person would call back and say, could you manage me? And I'd say, why? And he'd say, well, I got that big check from the publisher. I appreciate that, but I need someone to do stuff for me.
How old are you at this point? When is this?
23, 24, 25.
And people are just saying, hey, you know, you're helping me make money, and you never went to college then, I assume. Right?
I went to I did a year and a half at NYU from like 7 to 10 in the morning and 7 to 10 at night, and I worked at Lang during the day.
So what, you were in New York during the beginning of this, or did you come straight to LA after that year and a half?
So I was in high school in LA, worked for a couple labels, got an offer to work for Atlantic in marketing, but I had to move for New York. Uh-huh. I had just gotten into NYU.
Right.
So I tried to do both at the same time. Right. And I started a little 12-inch hip-hop label at that time I was doing as well. And then about a year and a half into that, I'd sort of burnt out. I had just signed Twista. I got offered a job to – I had produced a song
for
–
company.
I signed Twista to Atlantic.
Okay.
I was a marketing person.
Right.
But I brought him in, and we signed him. And then I had produced a record for The Far Side, and I had a job offer to come back to L.A. And thanks. And so I – turned in like a letter of resignation to Atlantic, and they said, oh, if you want to do A&R and move back to LA, there's actually a job available there to do that, and you don't have to leave the company.
Who was your boss at that point?
That was Craig Kalman, who was my boss for 17 years, believe it or not. But and then I went back and did LA full time, and sort of, you know, Craig was in New York, Atlantic was in New York. I was kind of out here, you know, had to figure it out with these, you know, rappers I was signing at the time and trying to make records.
Is that the same? I mean, I guess a lot of them were signed: Trey Songz, T.I., Flo Rida, and Wiz Khalifa, Twista. I mean, all these guys are sort of the same era when you're starting to sign them, or like, what?
Yeah,
I don't know, like, how you go from, you know, a white kid from from LA, and you have the most urban roster of
anybody in music
for a while. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, when I got into DJing, it was that time of Tribe Called Quest and Leaders of a New School, and a really exciting hip hop time. And then when I was doing marketing, I was sort of noticing these new genres. I went on the road with some acts through the South. I was at the era of Master P, and I went to Atlanta, Louisville, Knoxville, Nashville, Memphis. I saw through Ohio, saw what was happening with rap at the time. And then there was, you know, and what I was figured out with Axe was that there's all these A&Rs in the office. They'd all go to the Viper Room like every night, and they would always go to the Rainbow Room, and they were like, you know, they would have 200 different ways to describe like a woman's body. Like, and it was just, they were the same guys. They were like all black, and but they knew everybody in LA and New York. There was like a social club, and I wasn't in that social club. And I realized, you know what? I'm just going to ignore LA and New York. If there's a show, someone invites me to showcase, I'm not going.
Right.
I'm just going to focus on the rest of the country.
Right.
And so Twista was Chicago, Trick Daddy and Trina were Miami at that point. There were there hadn't been a successful rapper since Two Live Crew in Miami.
Wow.
So then people didn't look at Miami as a place for rap.
Were you flying in those cities, or people are sending you records? You know,
I was finding
school.
I was calling record stores and asking what local records were selling. I was talking to DJs. I was talking to the street team and the marketing contacts, asking people what was happening in the market. I'd go to the market as soon as I heard. But that area was Trick Daddy and Trina. It was Nappy Roots from Kentucky. It was Twista. It was, some point, it became Trey Songz and T.I. and Young Dro. And that was the first 10 years. And then in that time, there was all those publishing things, you know, people, producers, writers, I kind of discovered and got publishing deals. And then at one point I was turning down all the management because I was like, I'm an A&R person.
Right.
I'm not a manager. I'm not a super, you know, massager, people person. I'm like, a guy who.
Yeah, I mean, you've traveled around the country. You've met all kinds of different people.
Yeah.
And why don't you think of yourself as a people person?
Well, I think there's sort of like diametrically opposed. Inverse. So somebody who likes to listen to a lot of music and shut themselves in the studio and experiment is not the person who's going to be the social person.
Right.
So you kind of have to know when you meet someone who's incredible, social, dynamic, they're out every night, that they're also probably not going to, you know, get back to you and give you comments on your music and constructive criticism and insights and know every songwriter's, you know, talents and be able to pair you with your yin to your yang.
It's one of those things that I tell writers, like, you don't want an A&R guy who likes all your songs. You want the A&R guy who, when you send your shitty song, they say, send another, because they're willing to listen through your shitty songs because they'll find it or they believe in you as a writer.
Yeah.
And, somehow, I don't know when in your schedule you're listening to music, but you manage to at least come back with comments every time someone sends you songs. And even when you're not... I'm not signed to you and I still send you songs. You still have always responded with, this isn't right or this is cool. What if you did? And you listen enough to at least respond. And that's hard to do for anybody.
To me, it's essential because if I don't respond, if I don't give you like some real clarity that I'm paying attention, I'm listening, I'm thinking deeply, I'm not just skimming the surface, then you're not going to keep sending me the music because it would be a waste of your time.
Yeah.
You know? And so I want to make sure that the people I believe are talented know I'm fully engaged, I prioritize. I get back right away. I'm really thinking about it.
That's such a people person thing. It's so interesting. I mean, maybe that's also because it's in a place where you're on your own listening, and so you're in your zone, and it doesn't have to be a conversation. I mean, I imagine that that's probably something that's obviously an advantage if you're focused and in your own world responding to stuff. But that seems like a social interaction.
You probably socially when you're to do it right socially, it's just also an investment of time. It's patience. It's a lot of listening. And the other thing, I have this, you know, this a lot of opportunity on behalf of all the people I work with, and I want to take advantage of it. So I probably, you know, the social thing, I probably blow things too quickly through to things, you know, to deliver for the people, but maybe not be as present as I should. But it's funny, you mentioned you don't want an A&R person who likes everything. You do, but everybody has that. It's called their mother.
Right.
So,
Like,
I want to meet the person whose mother hates everything and gives them constructive feedback, and then they don't need me.
That's right. Exactly. So you go from, I might be off, but as a sort of sole producer, I Love College is kind of like the last one where you were primarily focused on being a producer, or at least the balance. I feel like somewhere there was this shift between, I'm not going to focus as much time in the studio as a producer, and I'm going to get more into the business side. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, producing for me is like, there's this category of things I have that include playing golf, video games, being into certain types of TV shows, and heroin and crack cocaine.
Right.
Those are like things I never want to try because I know they're addicting and they're probably, you probably get hooked on one of them. So I would say the closest thing I have to that is making tracks by myself, just, or with, a musician because I'm not a great player, and just, sampling and chopping and doing drum and just making records from scratch. And I love to do that. And I guess I've given up more and more of that. I think, at the time having kids, that probably eat into that time, just as people's, golf game probably goes down with their kids. So, but I also, I think as a DJ oriented producer that, chopping stuff up and using a lot of that stuff, that era has sort of changed a little bit. So now what I'm doing is, producing in probably the way that hasn't, that was the A&R producer of the 60s, which is, figuring out people's strengths and talents and putting them together and calling, pulling someone in. I mean, I think I have probably in some ways a terrible reputation, in some ways a great reputation for, telling someone at some point, like, you probably hit the wall on this. How about bringing in another producer to finish it? And it's sort of insulting to some people, and other people love it. They like, realize they want the final product, and ultimately a you know, the traditional producer is somebody who gets something all the way to the finish line.
Right.
And sometimes that means recognizing, you know, the players on the team that it needs, you know, the one position is being unfulfilled and needs to come in.
But, I mean, is that just a title change? Is record exec? Because, well, we know A&R guys who don't do this. So, I mean, do you consider yourself a producer? Because you're on these records as A&R, not necessarily as a producer, even though you are doing the 1960s form of producing. I mean, is it hard to sort of compartmentalize the, I'm an A&R guy, I'm the head of this company, that company, and I'm a producer and I'm a writer. Yeah. I mean, how do you compartmentalize that, and how do the people you work with compartmentalize you?
Well, that's the challenge we all have, is to try to get ourselves not to compartmentalize ourselves. Start not to look at somebody, he's a writer, he only writes, he's not an artist, he's not a playwright, he's not a, you know, a podcaster, he's, you know, and we're in a world where there's, you know, first of all, we're in an industry where you probably have to do more than one thing to, you know, survive, but they're also interlinked and complementary. And to be a, you know, a manager, you have to be a marketer, and you have to be a negotiator, and there's so many roles. So I would just say that, I think my role is to be a utility player. Sometimes it's to find songs. Sometimes it's to match talent. Sometimes it's to find somebody who can get what's needed done. And I try to get people to have an open mind that, you know, sometimes I'm acting as a publisher and sometimes I'm acting as a, you know, label. And it's, you know, I tried my best to state my intention. And I think I have like a reputation for being direct and honest.
Right.
So I think when I say like I'm the reason I'd like to do this is for this, and that is, there's no, you know, ulterior motive other than, you know, what I lay out, which is generally to get just the best product, because ultimately I think that's where it benefits everyone. And what kills me is those records that, like, somebody told me you never want an 11, 6, or 2. Like,
what do you mean?
Well, you know, you want a top 10, a top 5, or a number 1.
Right.
You know? And so what kills me is, why would a record end at 11 or 6? Like, or even, you know, 3? What stopped it? What was wrong with it? What could have been better? What did we do right, wrong in the promotion, in the rollout, in the recording, in the artist's career, that the song would get to 3, but it wouldn't get to number 1.
What's an example of that? I actually know of a few under 8, just from having talked to you guys. Like, always the biggest surprise to me is the fact that Wild Ones came out during maybe the best year of singles since I've been a professional songwriter.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's Call Me Maybe, Gautier, and Payphone, and We Are Young, and all these great songs were coming out at the same time. You know, real classic songs in a way. And here's maybe the most classic Flo Rida song, next to My House, of course. But, you know, why does that song not go number 1?
Like, that's number 2. Yeah, I have to remember exactly what was number 1. Sometimes it's just, you know, it might have been stuck behind Gautier, and that was just such a unbelievably perfect record in every way.
Right.
Like, I flew to Melbourne from New York, like, which is a long trip, for a day to try to make that happen. And that was,
what do you mean, did you sign him, or
I tried to.
Yeah.
It was ended up between being us and Republic, and anyways, long story, but that was an experience. But that song was just on within, you know, it was just one of those songs where in 30 seconds you're like, this is the best thing I've heard in years.
Right.
And then every 30 seconds it gets better and better and better and better. And you're like, there's nothing you could have done to make it better. It has the song evolved. It was exciting. It was interesting. The production was perfect. It made you just want to play it over and over and over again and never get tired of it.
Right.
I think a lot of people make their judgment on a song on first listen, which I think it's almost more important that after 10 listens or 20 listens, you're so excited to hear it again. But yeah, why Wild Ones? Wild Ones isn't a good example, because I think it got to number 2 when there was just traffic at 1.
Right.
It was weird on that album because Good Feeling got to two, Wild Ones got to two, and Whistle was the one that got to one.
Yeah, that's kind of surprising.
And that, yeah, I wouldn't have guessed that. But there was, I remember Good Girls Gone Bad, yeah. Cobra Starship. Sure. I have a theory with that one.
You wrote on that too, right? Or no?
I didn't. I
know it's Jay Cash. I know it's
it was Kara and Kara, Gabe, right. and Kevin.
Right.
Rudolph.
Right.
We were putting, that was our very, very first little tiny room we had at Paramount Studios. And we were just, it was my gear from home. You know, my fiance had moved in. I got Atlantic to pay a couple grand a month to put a room in. I put a minimum wage engineer, and we just ran round the clock sessions, experiments. And Aaron ran that session that got right round. That right. It was his idea to do the interpolation, and we got Cobra Starship that year. But I argued that the post-chorus repeated. If you listen to the song, they repeat the line "Good Girls Gone Bad" like 60 times or something. And I argued that, you know, repetition is good, but there's a fine line where if you just run the math after you've heard the song 100 times, you've actually heard that line 6,000 times.
Sure.
And like, you know, when you see most of radio research is wacky and unpredictable, and I disagree with a lot of it, but that one was kind of clear. The song, you know, ascended, and it hit this point where they measure burnout. And it just became, and immediately when it got in the top 10, it just burned out and tanked because people were like tired. They were like pulling their hair out after they had heard the song a certain amount of times.
Right.
And it was that amount of balance between catchiness and repetitiveness. And it was just, it worked on the short end of it being very repetitive. So second time you heard it, you were able to sing along. But
are your competitors / contemporaries, you know, thinking of like Luke and Max and the people who run their sort of, you know, Prescription, MXM, and, you know, probably what's going on in the Benny Stargate world and some of these different groups of people, they all have song math. I always talk about song math. Is that a universal truth in songwriting, or is it, do you have your song math? Is that something you can teach?
I think it's like,
if you're listening to that song, you're saying this was repetitive too much. And then, you know, I hear some of these songs, including one of mine that's doing well right now. And I'm like, that's a really repetitive chorus.
It's kind of like,
it's sort of a surprise that it's doing. To me, I'm like, that's fantastic. I don't have other songs that I repeat a chorus that much, but I don't know where the burnout rate is. You know, I don't, you know, that's going to be interesting to see.
You'll come to your conclusions and it will affect how you write the next one. But I think that whole, the different theories, song math, all that stuff, it's like, you know, it's like being an artist. You have like a straight edge ruler, but you're not going to use that in every painting. You have these tools and you want to, you know, you're creative. You don't want to write the same thing over or use the same blueprint. There is things that work. Like, you know, you have a film. It's got almost every movie we see has three acts, and they have almost the same high concept arc to those acts. You have certain like laws of psychology. I always talk about there's these rules to advertising, actually, where it's like kids, when you're advertising to kids, you want food to be fun and toys to be serious.
Yeah.
And like, you don't want to put, like for a film, you want to put a crazy person in a normal world or a normal person in a crazy world, because a normal person in a normal world is boring and a crazy person in a crazy world is absurd.
Right.
So you do have these things, but generally you then throw them all out. And it's why I'm a big fan of at least a second idea started every day, because it's like you maybe in the first idea, that's where you're sort of following some structure, you feel some sort of pressure, you want to, you know.
Yeah, we call that a Hail Mary.
You want to be a productive.
That last hour, you know, you have only enough time. Everyone has to leave at this time. So you just say, okay, we finished this idea. You have 1 hour. First instincts go, just enjoy it. Have fun. And I can't tell you how many songs we have that have been cut in the last hour.
Yeah. So what I try to do, and I don't want to, like, you know, give away too much, but I like, you know, having the studios in the
there you go.
Having the studios in the office, one of the things I do is I give people their, you know, I try to stay out of them for a lot of times, give people time to, like, you know, not feel pressure, not have someone over their shoulder. Yeah. But I try to dip in and see when they've got that first idea to a point where it's an idea and it's down, and then, you know, and then push them to the next idea.
Sure.
Because you can, you know, when you say that last hour, it could be that last 3 hours. 3 hours. It could be that last hour could be the third idea. When the first idea is like enough where you have it, you can save it, you can revisit it with fresh ears. But I feel like a lot of sessions, they just run on too long, and people just, when you've looped a song forever, you start hearing it in a way. And we have the technology that allows you to, you know, go outside. Like in our new facility, it's in a, like a, you know, a culturally relevant populous place, not in a back corner, like on in Burbank, hidden in some place. And I want people to get out, you know, to go take a walk between songs, to go down the street, come back, go have coffee,
walk
whatever.
Through doors. Somebody said that to me. Just walk through a door.
Yeah.
It's amazing how much, even if you, that's why everyone we know has written their best lyric while they're pissing or while they're showering or something. They just, it's a, not an environment that's, that they have to focus on something else, or you're pissing on a wall, you know?
There's this book about creativity that was debunked, but it had all these interesting things about, you know, hot showers and being relaxed and your creative ideas, you know, clearing out your mind. Well, the guy used some quotes that he attributed to Bob Dylan that were, Bob Dylan says he never said, and so it was sort of like taken off the shelves because it was. But there were a lot of theories about what drugs were like or conducive to writing hits. You look at these eras of, you know, soul music versus disco music, and the drugs people were doing, and well, you know, uppers versus downers, all that stuff. But being in the shower. And I noticed, you said being in the shower or pissing, I noticed that the real hits, like, are the ones that just pop into your head while you're doing one of those things.
Yeah.
You clear your mind, you're not thinking, and this earworm comes back. You're like, wow, that was a really sticky earworm if I'm not thinking of anything.
Yeah.
And it's the, you know, or the first thing when you wake up in the morning. You just came out of sleep, you wake up, and all of a sudden, you're like, you know, this little melody is stuck in your head.
Yeah.
You're like, wow, how's that, you know, that thing survived the night's sleep.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
One thing that's crazy about you, that there's, you know, there's probably one of the things that's crazy about you. I could just go, I'm like, there's like this long list I have. But half the people that we've interviewed are not good singers.
Mm.
You know, and that you must hear these ideas, and then for you to get them out is a very peculiar, like, prospect. Because, you know, it's one of those things that you'll come into a room and say, no, it needs to be like, and you try to sing it, but you hear it, but you try to translate it. Is that, how do you deal with that?
It's hard because I can't sing. People all make fun of me because I do try, because what am I going to do?
Exactly.
Not get the message out? Or worse, I don't do my best to articulate it, and then someone, I'm very sensitive to people's time, so I don't want them wasting time, their own time, without enough information. So I actually try to, you know, if I can't, I can hear the note. So if I'm singing it too low or trying not to, I'll like actually point my finger a little higher to
say,
this is where I'm trying to get.
Yeah.
But I can get the cadence down. And then I try to, you know, they say, you know, people can, it's so dangerous to use words to describe music. Because if I'm talking about something that's really hard and heavy and has like an aggressive track, like you could be thinking, you know, a Skrillex song, and someone else could be thinking a Metallica song.
Right.
You know, like you actually have to play the music. And I, you know, that's where DJing comes in so handy. Right. And you could say, like, you know, I'm looking for this sort of run or this sort of, you know, oscillation or whatever. Listen to this, you know, song from 72 where it does it. Now you got to actually be careful about that, because there's, you know, this whole lawsuits that can happen just from a reference or So
does that scare you? I mean, obviously it scares the shit out of me.
You know what? It scares me on behalf of songwriters. So here's the truth of what happens, right? You write the song, you have, you know, minding your business, you're trying to come from the soul and happens to have some sort of, you know, similarity to something, or some, you know, person who knows nothing about music comes to some conclusion, and you get sued because it's a hit. They may be suing because they know it's not that similar, but they think that they're gonna, you know, you're gonna pay them to go away, because the truth is your money is frozen. Right. Like, you know, and as a songwriter,
I mean, E&O insurance is like, I don't know. Keep going. Sorry.
Well, it's almost like becomes blackmail, you know?
Right.
You have half a million coming to you. You have your, you know, you've been scraping nickels together because, you know, it takes so long for income to come as a songwriter. And then you finally have this money coming, and someone comes out of the woodwork saying it sounds like XYZ. Yeah. They know it doesn't, but they know that if you're going to, you know, to get your $1 million, they have to go away.
Yeah.
And they can just be a needle in your side and hold up that money for years. So, you know, you're going to peel off something to pay, which is just so
gross.
You know, it's gross. It's just so unethical and so gross. And what choice do you have?
Is there a way to eliminate that, or is that just sort of, that's just life?
I think there has to be. I mean, I think there has to be a fear that bringing these completely frivolous things, not doing the diligence, not having, you know, legitimate claims, needs to have a cause. You need to dissuade people from having something that they haven't done. I mean, I've talked to people with claims, and sometimes I've said, like, how much, you know, how many third parties, I mean, how many people have you gone to for counsel on this, or is this strictly your own opinion?
Right.
And they say, it's my opinion, my lawyer agreed.
Right.
Your lawyer, who knows, can't play an instrument, knows nothing
right.
about music, and I'm like, you're gonna like affect somebody's family and their life for something that you haven't even done your own diligence on,
right.
And they have a lawyer who's working on contingency who thinks he's just gonna get paid to go away, and it's there's no repercussion because if their lawyer's doing it on contingency, they're not out anything if they lose. There needs to be some sort of damages for.
Is that something
need
that
to
has
be,
to go through politics, or is that something
I don't know. I'd have to get like a there have to be a lawyer, but there should be the interest on the money that they're holding up, or something. There has to be something to it. There has to be some cost to it. I mean, there's a cost if people are paying legal fees
for
that. But what lawyer is going to tell you, don't hire me to do this? You know?
Right, of course. Are there people in the industry? There are a couple things that you actually mentioned that I had written down before. One was, you really enjoy the art of business.
Mm.
You really like the negotiating.
Mm.
I don't know. I happen to really like the business side. I like dealing with it. I like hearing about it. I like understanding this issue that we're talking about now with insurance or the idea of frivolous lawsuits. But a lot of people who are creative, and if you're as a producer, we know a lot of producers who can barely get out of bed and show up to the studio, let alone study, read books about how the psychology
sure.
of business. Where does the desire to be a good negotiator come from? And that seems like a correct analysis of you. Am I wrong?
Well, I would say I enjoy being creative, and the thing I learned early in the music business is that you can be pretty creative on the deal making side. I mean, you can really be creative in any type of business, but
sure.
I think the first publishing deal I did was with a writer who had been a successful artist in his past. He wasn't a successful artist at the time, and you know, I made him an offer, and he said, well, considering, you know, my successful artist career, I think, you know, it should be more, this, you know, offer should be more substantial. And I said, well, you know, we're only talking about working on third-party records, not on your own artist
right.
records. And he said, and I said, you know what, maybe I could offer you a publishing deal that excludes your own artist records. But I didn't know that existed at the time. And then as I sort of investigated, I found out, you know, you can do a deal. You can do anything. You can do a deal that's only a song somebody writes on Tuesdays, you know?
Right.
It could be, you know, and then so all of a sudden the unlimited.
Hard to keep track of that.
Yeah, exactly. unlimited potential for what's out there and how things are structured. And I think it's important to find a recipe for success for someone, for honestly plan it out. I mean, I know I always go up against the fact that I know what other people's pitches are to new artists, and I know I cannot pitch a bold-faced lie. And I'm not saying that, you know, other people do that even intentionally. But you meet with an artist in November, a new artist you're interested, and they want to hear that their album's going to be out in the spring and they're going to be on tour in the summer.
Yeah,
right? That's what they want to hear. They're looking for someone to tell them that. Right. Somebody could tell them that. Is it possible? You know, it's possible to win the lottery.
No,
it's possible to do, you know, a lot of things. Your odds are
highly against you. Yeah, you can release it in a vacuum, but no one's going to, right. Yeah,
I've done, I did a study of all my artists from zero to gold of all the acts I've signed, and I've had 19 that have gone gold or platinum, and the average is 2.8 years to reach that point.
Did you do that math, or did you actually hire someone to
No, I did the math. I looked at how when I signed them, when their first album went gold. Sometimes it wasn't their first album, sometimes it was a second, and then I averaged it out across a bunch of acts. I think I only averaged out that from the acts that were successful that got there, not including the ones, because then there would be infinity, and then you know. But so you know, you, and not saying that they couldn't make a living or had success in less than that time period. Some of them.
Well, there's an industry between zero and gold.
Yeah,
it's just
exactly.
Not the same industry that you're focusing on or aspiring.
Not what people have in mind when they're signing a record deal.
Of course.
You know. So you realistically, you know, it is going to be a time period. Actually, I have this whole theory about artists. So many artists were dropped by major labels and signed again. Like we're successful.
Oh, yeah.
Alicia
Bruno.
Keys, 50 Cent.
Yeah, right.
We have, I mean, just Atlantic, Bruno, Fun, Ed Sheeran, CeeLo, T.I., all these artists we've had success with, Charlie Puth, they were all signed and dropped. And I think the number one reason is a lot of these mega artists were so immensely talented that people recognized it very early in their career. But when they sign them, the artist, the manager, the A&R, the label, all have this internal clock of 2 years.
Right.
And they all think that something needs to happen in 2 years or everyone starts to feel like something is wrong in the formula. And maybe some of those acts, the real timeline from being signed from raw talent and not actually figured out your sound, your performance, your collaborators, your essential things.
Sure.
Maybe that time period's actually 4 years. And so people are really on this window where they get signed 18 months
well,
in, 2 years, they get dropped, and they the second deal on about the year, 2 years, that's that four-year window.
Part of it is because they've run out of money. Either the label spent too much money, or the artist doesn't have enough money, and you as a label are saying, I already paid you.
So
you're sitting there, and 2 years into it, you're like, either I have to find a way to continue to put money into this.
Exactly. So then you face the conundrum where you are then realize you're in this marathon and you may need this money to last for 4 years. And the way you're doling it out seems stingy. But when you know you're in what's best for the artist and what's best for the company because you need to make it work for that period of time, it's tricky.
Well, so one of the things that bothers me as a writer is that songs that haven't been released, they have this infinite lifespan until they get cut.
Sure.
But in this generation, once a song is released, unless it's sampled, it's rarely cut again.
Yeah.
And you go back 30 years or 50 years, going back to Bob Dylan, you have some of these songs that are cut by 50 different artists.
And that will change. And it'll just take somebody to change it. Somebody will have success with a cover. Somebody will have success, you know, you'll get hot as a writer. All of a sudden, your unreleased songs that people were ignoring, they all like them now.
But it's not the unreleased songs. It's the songs that basically got dropped. It's the fact that, you know, if I have a song that there are songs that you've liked of mine that an artist has released.
The one that I wanted that Rixon cut and put on that thing.
Appreciate it.
It's
a great example
song.
Of that. That song is a great song that sold very few records, and the song's still great.
Well, here's something that we do on the record side and the publishing side that's an industry problem, right? I think Appreciated is an amazing song. You know, we on the version we worked on, we tried a bunch of different productions. That code hasn't been exactly cracked.
Right.
So the song is a incredible song, massive song, still hasn't been produced. So not only does it need to be covered, but it needs to be covered with a new arrangement or production. And so you need someone who not only understands that everything comes in cycles and is this great wealth of songs that have been done, but also can hear them and reimagine them. And then here's the trickiest part, right? You then have to get producers that are willing to produce that don't participate in the publishing, which we have to shift. The government has to shift. There has to be a even balance between publishing income and record income, or you know, performance from master income that levels it, that then encourages producers to work on records again, and because that's where the covers are going to come from.
And same thing on the other side, though. I still think of the fact that writers don't have control of the masters at all is really, it works from the Grammys down, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I always say that every year that the Grammys come out, you know, I put it on social media that every year that the Grammys don't include songwriters in album of the year categories is a year they don't understand how albums are made. And this is the wrong era for that kind of thing. And that philosophy of these songwriters have these songs being, you can have a song cut by all these different artists, which is where that really comes from, is just fictitious now. It's just not really how it works. And we don't own any percentage of the, we only make money if the song makes money, and without any sort of album cuts out there, we don't get anything. We just don't make any money. There's no middle class for songwriters. There's, if you write hits, you're stoked. And underneath that, you're kind of screwed because these songs have just limited value, and a producer can demand $40,000 for a track.
It is tricky. I mean, you know, it's the same. It's not the same in television, but it's becoming that way in film. It's a zero-sum game a lot of the time. There's a lot of people
who
are...
What do you mean? How is it the same?
Meaning that, you know, that most films are either hugely successful or they lose a lot of money, and anyone on a participation basis is not seeing a dollar from it, you know?
Yeah, but the key grip still gets paid something. So even if, you know, the fact that I go into a session and there's no, that if the song gets cut and if there's an exclusive use of that song for its initial release, then there should be money that's trickled down to the writers of it and not specifically just to the producer. The producer is also a writer in most cases, so they can participate in that as well. But there should be something that reflects the work that the writers put in that for every cut, besides a split of 9.1 cents per song.
It's definitely tricky. It will be very hard to get to a perfect scenario. But there's also the producer fees, what a producer's role is, what a songwriter's role is. Sometimes the producers are using the songwriters to produce vocals to, you know, that they're more involved in the production than just a writer credit would lead you to believe.
I mean, especially when it comes to writing to tracks, which is sort of a dying art in a way. As Savin said to me once, he's like, it's like writing a screenplay to special effects.
See, you know? I would sort of disagree with that in the sense that that it's, you know, it depends like on the sound and style and where the innovation and how the ability to execute is a production and the groove and the feel at the time, because like there's the one rule I know is that there's no rules. You know, and sometimes the inspiration is going to come from sitting at a piano, and sometimes that is going to continue to lead to a lot of, you know, middle of the road, mid-tempo, and there's just something in the brain that, like, you're just not going to write a drum and bass song on a guitar, and it's like, it's or some new genre that doesn't even exist as of now, you know? So I would just say, like, there's, you know, you got to remember It's the Brian Eno. Oblique strategies. You know, sometimes the greatest things just come from doing things differently.
Right.
You know, whatever your routine is. I say that to writers all the time. Like, whatever is your biggest struggle, you know, the thing you try to avoid, you don't want to do, is probably what you need to do the most. It's what's going to round you out.
I try really hard on varying rhythms. It's one of the things I've learned a lot in the last couple years, is really getting better and better at how I use rhythm. As a writer, it's like, it's always been to me that's always been my Achilles heel. Been a really good melody writer, a good lyric writer, but rhythms are always something that's like an interesting thing. Understanding counter rhythms, understanding syncopation better, getting into that has really been sort of a useful tool as a writer.
Yeah.
But do you have a favorite kind of producer, a favorite kind of writer? I mean, you have so many under your
My favorite
under your
kind of
umbrella.
Writer is the.
One who writes hits.
The one favorite kind of writer is the one that has the highest bar, you know, and figures out a way to get there. You know, Ed Sheeran and Bruno and Charlie and just guys who are like, they're open-minded but confident, and they don't get high on their own supply. They realize that what great is. Is not and realize it's not going to come easy. I mean, I remember seeing a lot of writers that I thought were just sort of mythological beings that just, you know, coughed out smashes. And everyone that I got a closer look on worked their ass off.
Yeah.
And when you finally got into it, it did not come easy. It took work, you know.
Would you have built any of this differently now that you see how successful APG is? I mean, obviously, I know that we didn't even get into the A&R for Warner Records, which is a massive role. You know, would you have done any of it differently, or is it sort of?
Yeah, here's the greatest the hardest lesson that took the longest that I'll share and everyone will ignore, which is that. And this is so hard. You can learn it, you can agree to it, and then putting it into practice is almost impossible. That people evolve, and that, you know, just like we were saying, how you got to not, you know, label somebody and classify them. It's that you have to continue to have an open mind and revisit them, because where someone is at 17 and at 18 and at 20 and at 22, and where they are before they've, before Lucas has matched with Spielberg, or like, you know, I mean, but Bernie Taupin found Elton John, or, you know, Bruno Mars found Peter Hernandez found Phil Lawrence, however you want to say that. Like the yin and the yang and the chemistry, everything changes. Ryan Lewis and Macklemore, listen to, you know, that before.
Them separate.
Well, at least, Macklemore's stuff is out there separate. So it just is something else. And you have to, like, it's so easy to say, I heard that guy, I saw him in the studio, like, he does this and that's what he is.
Right.
And here's my, you know, description on him, and that's it. A year from now, you have to listen to him and say, he could be totally different, especially in these formative years of people's careers. So it's like, to see every artist once isn't enough.
It's
so hard.
It's like you know, people are as successful as the day you meet them, that you see someone who's homeless and you don't realize that they were rich one. They could have been rich one day, or somebody who's rich might have been homeless, or just the idea of anybody. I mean, it's so easy to look at them and view them as, I met you being a very successful, you know, record exec. You had this building already, you know, but the idea that there was a time where you were probably sending out songs that weren't very good, you know? Is like, it was a long time ago. So it's people who met you then. That's what's cool about the Will I Am thing.
I'm still dealing with that. I started it's in the business at 16. I was at Atlantic at 17. Or sorry, 15. I was at Atlantic 17, A&R at 19, and I made so many mistakes in the first 10 years.
Right.
There's definitely people who still hold those against me and like assume I'm just still the way I, you know, the things. And half of it was I didn't know. I did things the best way I knew how to get them done at the time. And things happen in your life. You have to reevaluate and have an open mind. That's it. It's a constant open mind all the time.
Yeah. Well, two things. One is, you have to put that top 40 that you guys used to always keep above the urinal.
Oh, that's a good point.
Because that was something that when I first started coming here, I used to look at that list, and it used to really inspire me, because everybody who pisses in this place would have the top 40 right in front of their face, and you'd see in italics all the ones that Atlantic, APG, probably now Warner would have, and you'd look at that list, and you'd think, man, I want to get on that list. Yeah. You know, like, you have to bring that up, especially because I have a bunch on there now. but you know, it's like I went in and I was pissing, I'm reading some shitty sign, and I'm like, come on, man, that top 40 has to be there. Okay. That shit inspired me.
Yeah. You know? I love that. I mean, that's one of my main focuses now, as, you know, moving into the larger role and managing a larger group, is how to continue inspiration. One of the things we've been doing for our writers is every month, we have each A&R person, and actually every employee of the publishing company, pick a song or two that inspired them over the last month. What about it is special? And we send it to all our writers. And, you know, we assume, like, our writers hear the same things we hear, but that a lot of times that doesn't happen. Right. And second, it helps for the writers to get to know the employees and what their taste and tone is. And somebody likes this, I'm going to send them that idea, or I'm going to ask them how I can get involved in this style of music or whatever it is. So, and I'm trying to do that. We tried the poster series. We have a couple of them. The next one, I want to be all about inspiration. So,
yeah, that educating is, I mean, that's one of the things that I've always admired about you. And I think it's been good for all the writers that you've come across, is that it's about education. I mean, you really come in here and you talk about, there are times when you say, you know, those kinds of post courses are gone. And because you're listening to music more than anybody that's coming out, because people send you so many songs, that you're listening to a lot of these things, say, this trend has moved on, this trend is moving forward. And whether you're right or not, it's constantly about evolving, like you were saying, and that evolution has really affected a lot of writers in this industry.
I have a list of titles that I share with my writers to avoid, and they say, why should I avoid this? I was like, well, these are the titles that I'm getting 8 songs a week of with the same title, and no artist is taking it.
Right.
And even though the title could work, of course, there's no rules, it could work, but there's so many songs being written with the same title that you're more likely to have a song and then your competitor comes out with the same title, because there's hundreds of songs being written.
I can't imagine how many Netflix and Chills or whatever it is.
And then there's
just
titles
that
never,
you know,
ever, ever work, although I'll challenge someone to write a hit song called Boomerang, but somehow I get a song called Boomerang every week.
Yeah.
Every week is a song called Boomerang.
Well, there's a gimmick. The gimmick song right now is really difficult. I think it's easy for people to still look back and say, I want my umbrella. And they try to come up with a multisyllabic word that everyone understands. And they just go and they try to write that. And that's just not really where concepts come from. A compelling concept about a boomerang, you know, is a very difficult thing. It just becomes a club record that nobody's listening to. Nobody's listening to that song.
But when a lot of writers, they
that's I really
find
funny
young
though.
Writers,
Boomerang
they,
is, yeah, because I know some of your writers who have that song already, and maybe even release that song.
I'm sure they've all tried it.
You
gotta get it out of your system at some point. But yeah, there's those ones. But the multisyllabic, I think people, you know, they understand that works and it's catchy, and they don't really know why.
Sure.
And then when
appreciate it. I try to explain that with writer's suits. If you want, it's okay to be, it's not okay to be wordy, but it's okay to use a lot of notes. If you have multisyllabic words stringing together, it can be a very simplistic phrase and can cover a lot of real estate. The more you have these multisyllabic words, the more you can take up space without it being wordy. So if you have the wordier your song, the more rhythmic your song, the bigger the words in a way have to be in order to offset that.
Well, another reason why it works so well is because if you're trying to get someone to sing along, they logically can sing along the first time they hear it. So if I say Cali, you're gonna finish Fornia with it.
Right.
The same way if I say 1, 2, 3, you're gonna say 4. Same way if you say A, B, you're gonna say C.
Right.
And those things, those spelling, left, right, left, or, you know, hot or cold, black, it's just the brain works. So if your goal is to surprise them and to outwit them and to challenge someone's thoughts, you're going to go against that. And if your challenge is to corral everyone on first listen, you're going to, you know, use the way, if it's a bunch of one syllable words, they're going to have to hear the song several times to
I'm smiling because this is what it's like to first meet you, and you have explained a lot of these rules so many times, and it still works. Those rules are rules for a reason on some level.
I try not to use the word rules.
No, okay.
They're tools.
They're tools for a reason, but you understand the pitfalls of them, and you know, and how to use that to your advantage as a writer, but. It's one of those things that there aren't a lot of A&R people who are that involved in the art of song craft. And
so much
and those
fun.
Notes.
I just enjoy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for
this is fun.
For this. Always
good
I appreciate
to talk.
It. Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us on iTunes. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to Jeff Sparger, David Silberstein from Mega House Music, and Michael White. Here's a sneak peek of next week's And the Writer Is.
He was like, he couldn't believe that these two skinny Norwegians made this music. So it was just like a chemistry that was instant.
Sure.
And again, it doesn't matter where you come from in music, as long as you share the same passion and references and love for music. And he quickly understood that, oh, these guys know what they're doing, and vice versa. We're just breathtaking by his talent and his voice and his writing.
Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.